The Right Question is funded by the Steele Reese Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is nonfiction collage?
I call it literary collage. It's a work in which the organization is not the expansion of plot, it's the exfoliation of theme. So that essentially the reader is reading not for what happened next, but rather the reader is reading to slowly but surely put together the pieces of the puzzle of the book. It's meant to have tremendous forward momentum, but key to it is that the reader get that the book is indeed coming together. It looks like that you're throwing in everything but the kitchen sink, but really, the book has a beautiful subtext to it.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Seattle author David Shields about his book, How Literature Saved My Life. I just want to say that I was dazzled by this book. You can see that my copy has dozens of little sticky tabs.
I may need to take a photograph of that. That's pretty cool.
And those are all places where I want to go back and reread and rethink about what you wrote. But it definitely didn't feel like it had a beginning, a middle, and an end in the traditional way.
The book has an undeniable poetic argument to me. It begins with an ode on my part to Ben Lerner, his book, Leaving the Atosha Station, which sets the agenda of my book, namely, how in this highly simulated society can we feel anything, let alone how can we create art? That sort of gets my book going. I then talk about my own ambivalence toward everything. I talk about my inability or my ability to love somebody else. I talk about the melancholy nature of my mind and perhaps the human mind in general. I talk about my thanatophobia, my obsession with mortality. And then at some point, I'm about in graduate school at this point, I flirt none too seriously with suicidal gestures. I find refuge in literary art. That quickly pales. I start wanting a much more naked art, and then I wonder if I even want art or just an artfully organized life. And then at the end of the book, it comes full circle, and I find an affirmation in highly self-conscious art, which is, of course, ironically and paradoxically, where we began with my paralyzing self-consciousness. And so the books I come to love, the books I love to read, the book that you are indeed reading in front of you is a work that, to me, bridges the gap between human loneliness by being unusually candid about one's own life. And so, to me, the book has an unmistakable movement, an unmistakable meaning. It's just subtly done.
There was one point, I think it was in the late 90s, where you stopped writing fiction, you stopped wanting to read fiction, you even stopped wanting to teach fiction. Tell us about that transition.
That was a very crucial transition for me, and I always think of it as my Alice down the rabbit hole moment, from which I've never quite completely recovered. Both of my parents were journalists. I grew up around the written word. I pivoted away from them slightly by becoming a fiction writer. I spent about almost 20 years writing fiction as a student, a graduate student. I wrote three novels. And then I was trying to write my fourth novel. And as I discuss in the book, I found myself, for a variety of reasons, bored by those typical novelistic gestures, above all, creating a plot, creating imaginary characters, giving those characters jobs, placing them deeply within a particular setting. I realized that really wasn't where my interest or even my strength lay. And so I moved away from creating a novel that wasn't really working to creating my first work of literary collage, my fourth book, a book called Remote, Reflections on Life in the Shadow of Celebrity, in which I wrote these 52 chapters, each of which gets at a different aspect of my or the culture's remoteness. And ever since that book, which was published in 96, here we are in 2013, you know, over the last sort of 17, 18 years, I've written probably 10 books of literary collage that I just find that technique terribly exciting because it really frees you up as a writer. And I think it frees you up as a reader, too. Basically, the way I see it is you take some huge cultural and human problem, remoteness, celebrity, race, mortality, and you might say conduct an investigation on it for 200 pages. You go anywhere you possibly want, confession, humor, cultural criticism, fiction, fantasy, diary entry, movie review, any darn thing you want, you pull in, as long as one, it gives you a deeper sense of your topic, and two, it's creating a subtle momentum in the course of the book. So you can see how key to literary collage is placing things in exactly the right order. Some people look at my books, I think of them as very casual or lazy readers who just think it's okay, he just sort of threw a bunch of things on the page. It's like, no, I didn't. You know, I promise you, it's really, really, really carefully organized. There's a line I say a lot that collage is not a refuge for the compositionally disabled. Or Picasso says, a great painting comes together just barely. And that's exactly the way I want my books to work. They definitely come together, but it takes an alert reader and it takes some really careful stitch work on my part.
Well, let's go back to your mention of suicide. And as you say, this wasn't a very serious contemplation on your part, but as you would expect in a book that has saved my life in the title, there are many, many references to death. What was the arc of your overall contemplation of that?
Of suicide? Or of life and saving one's life?
Yeah, of death. And from the first time you considered suicide, where did that thought take you?
Well, again, I wouldn't want to oversell it in the sense the book is not some huge cataclysmic, you know, Sturm und Drang about how I was on the brink of suicide and I picked up a copy of War and Peace and, you know, I suddenly found a reason to live.
No, it's a philosophical consideration.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I can't help but relate it to me, my lifelong struggle with stuttering. As a kid, I really had a horrible time speaking. And even through high school, college, graduate school, I've got increasing control over it. But you can still hear, either in the reading I'll give later, even in our conversation now, remnants of my speech impediment. And, you know, virtually the defining aspect of what makes us human, frankly, is that we have verbal speech. You know, you could say that chimpanzees have a kind of language, or dolphins or whales, but really no other species that I'm aware of communicates with words the way that we do. And so, if you feel robbed of speech, you really feel quite inhuman. You know, you really feel like a madman, you know, so that if you have a horrific stutter, a horrible speech block, as I don't have as many of them as I used to, but I still have them, and it's just utterly destabilizing in a very profound way. And so I think to the degree I was ever truly woebegone, it had a lot to do, I think, with the way in which my rather bad stutter just completely demolished my sense of self. And so you can see how literature, the written word, the beauty of books, turning, you might say, bad language into beautiful language, that lure holds immense appeal for me. You know, I'm very, very passionate about literature, and it's hard not to see it in relationship to my childhood stutter.
You also mentioned that we are the only animals who know that we're going to die, and that makes us consider death. I mean, animals running out in the woods aren't considering death.
I know. I think that's fascinating. I think about that all the time. I mean, I'm 56 years old. I'm hoping I'm pretty healthy. I hope I have another, if not 56 years to live, at least, you know, many decades of life to go. But I earlier wrote a book called The Thing About Life Is That One Day You'll Be Dead, which came out about 5 years ago. And, you know, I'm a completely secular human being. I'm sure that your listeners range from atheists to agnostics to quite serious religious believers. And, you know, to each her own or his own. I'm not here to proselytize about my atheism, but, you know, I'm quite convinced in my own nerve endings that, you know, this secular life is our entire existence. You know, I'm aware of the beauty of nature and, you know, the miracle of birth and all of that, but I don't believe in any kind of larger being, any kind of, resurrection or anything like that, any kind of secondary life reincarnation or anything like that. You know, this is it. This is our entire life, you know, dust to dust. And that's, you know, that's, as Cormac McCarthy says, you know, it is the fundamental issue of human life, death. It's just, it's hard to see how it's not. People creating religions, creating cathedrals, creating huge houses, creating families. I think how we respond to life has everything to do with how we reconcile ourselves to the fact of our mortality. And I just, you know, I'm a fairly self-conscious person. I'm very kind of self-questioning, self-doubting. So I'm very aware of death, and I'm also very aware of how do I deal with death. And I'm a pretty obsessive writer, and so, you know, I have 14 books I've published, and I have 5 more books coming out in the next 5 years. You know, I'm quite the writer rabbit. And I just love to write, and I hope that on some level, in some very corny way, I think I probably want my books to not only outlast me, but I want them to, you know, I want them to disturb the flow. I want them to affect how writers and readers think about books in the next generation and beyond. I mean, that's a rather grandiose ambition, but that is indeed my hope and my ambition, or perhaps fantasy.
Well, I think you're succeeding.
Oh, thanks. That's high praise.
I was interested in your view of myth. You mentioned that myth is an attempt to reconcile an intolerable contradiction. Can you explain that?
That's a slight paraphrase of Claude Lévi-Strauss, the French anthropologist. It's not a direct quote, so I haven't quoted him, but it's partly based on something that Claude Lévi-Strauss said. But a myth is an attempt to reconcile an impossible contradiction, to me, means that we tend to believe in certain mythologies because we can't process what is really going on. For instance, I'm someone who grew up on the West Coast. I lived a long part of my life on the East Coast, and then I moved back to the West Coast, to Seattle, and have lived the last 15 or so years in Seattle. And I feel somewhat mixed loyalties to the West Coast and the East Coast. And I'm very aware of the ways in which people on the East Coast hugely cartoonize and mythologize the West Coast. People on the West Coast do the same toward the East Coast. But for instance, the East Coast tends to a certain degree sort of condescend and patronize and romanticize and idealize and mythologize the West Coast as somehow a place only of nature or of mysticism or whatever. But the reality is all the cultural energies, to me, a huge majority of them, whether it's computers or music or artistic movements or food, whether it's through movies, television, a lot of what happens in the culture, in my view, begins in the West Coast. Maybe that's my West Coast chauvinism. But the East Coast, because certain media outlets are there, although the web has changed that, there's a sort of pretense that somehow the West Coast isn't part of the culture or something like that. But the East Coast has to end up always keep on telling itself these kind of self-perpetuating myths about how the East Coast is some kind of citadel of culture when it really isn't. It's just a kind of bank to me. And so that's an example to me of the ways in which a myth is an attempt to reconcile an impossible contradiction.
Someone mentioned to me this morning that the West is the place where you go to die and the East is the rebirth. And I'm saying, well, every place is West or East of some place.
That's a great point.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with David Shields about his book, How Literature Saved My Life. When we come back after a short break, he'll read a passage in which he ponders why he wishes the worst for Tiger Woods. Don't go away. Would you like to read the passage about Tiger Woods?
Sure, I'd be honored to. This chapter or subsection is called Negotiating Against Ourselves. My initial reaction when I saw on the web the report that Tiger Woods was seriously injured was, what's the matter with me that I hope he's been paralyzed or killed? Jealousy, the much ballyhooed Schadenfreude, the green-eyed fairway. Tiger is rich, famous, now infamous, semi-handsome, losing his hair, semi-black, the best golfer ever, still, married to a supermodel, no longer, of course. I wanted him to taste life's darkness. Genes and talent and hard work don't guarantee anything. Everything comes to naught. It's not enough for me to succeed. All my friends must fail. Or, I want to rise so high that when I shit, everyone gets dirty. At 2:30 a.m. on Friday, November 27th, 2009, Tiger drove his 2009 Cadillac Escalade into a fire hydrant, then into a tree, a minor accident. Lacerations about the face. His wife either rescued him by knocking out the back window with a golf club or caused the accident by hitting him with same. More likely the latter, given the news that emerged shortly afterward. I was disappointed that Tiger was okay for the nonce. But really, I think we all were. The only reason this minor traffic accident was given so much attention at first was so that we could all pretend to cheer him on, but really root for his demise. He was, is too perfect. He's now said to be, a la Mickey Mantle, a billion-dollar talent on dime store legs. Am I uniquely horrible? My wife Lori and I were watching a football game on TV when the star tailback was badly injured and taken off the field in an ambulance. Lori said, I can never watch football for more than 5 minutes without falling asleep. But as soon as someone is injured, I can't turn away. Why is that? Later on, what was absent from all the coverage of Tiger's self-destruction was even the slightest recognition that for all of us, the force for good can convert so easily into the force for ill. that our deepest strength is indivisible from our most embarrassing weakness, that what makes us great will inevitably get us in terrible trouble. Everyone's ambition is underwritten by a tragic flaw. We're deeply divided animals who are drawn to the creation of our own demise. Freud, what lives wants to die again. The life drive is in them, but the death drive as well. Note that he says them. Milan Kundera, anyone whose goal is, quote, something higher, must expect someday to suffer vertigo. What is vertigo? Fear of falling? No. Vertigo is something other than fear of falling. It is the voice of the emptiness below which tempts and lures us. It is the desire to fall against which, terrified, we defend ourselves. And the more righteous our self-presentation, the more deeply we yearn to transgress, to fall, to fail, because being bad is more interesting, exciting, erotic than being good. Even little children, especially little children, know this. When my daughter Natalie was 3, she was friends with 2 girls, sisters aged 3 and 4. The older girl, Julia, ran away from her mother, for which she was reprimanded. The younger girl, Emily, asked why and was told that running away was bad. "I want to do it," Emily said. Tiger needed to demolish the perfect marble statue he'd made of himself, the image of perfect rectitude. We were shocked, that his furious will to dominate his opponents on the golf course also manifested in an insatiable desire to humiliate countless sexual partners. We all contrive different, wonderfully idiosyncratic and revealing ways to remain blind to our own blindnesses. In the British television series Cracker, Eddie Fitzgerald is a brilliant forensic psychologist who can solve the riddle of every dark heart except his own. He gambles nonstop, drinks nonstop, smokes nonstop, is fat, and is estranged from his wife. Richard Nixon had to undo himself because, as hard as he worked to get there, he didn't believe he belonged there. Bill Clinton's fatal charm was, is, his charming fatality. His magnetism is his doom. They're the same trait. Someone recently said to me about Clinton, he could have been, should have been, one of the great presidents of the 20th century, so it's such a shame that, no, there's no if only in human nature. When George W. Bush was a young man, he said to his father, "Okay then, let's go, mano a mano, right now." The war of terror was the not so indirect result. In short, what animates us inevitably ails us, and vice versa. Because I stutter, I became a writer in order to return to the scene of the crime and convert the bloody fingerprints into abstract expressionism. As a writer, I love language as much as any element in the universe, but I also have trouble living anywhere other than in language. If I'm not writing it down, experience doesn't really register. Language has gone from prison to refuge, back to prison. Picasso said, "A great painting comes together just barely." And this fine edge of excellence gets more and more difficult to maintain. I yield to no one in my admiration of Renata Adler's novel Speedboat, which is, I think, one of the most originally and formally exciting books published by an American writer in the last 40 years, and which now has been reissued on exactly the same day that this book of mine has been published. And I hesitate to heap any more dispraise upon her much maligned memoir, Gone, which I must admit I still find utterly addictive. Surely, though, the difference between Speedboat and Gone derives from the fact that in the earlier book, the panic tone is beautifully modulated and under complete control, and often even mocked, whereas in the later book it's been given, somewhat alarmingly, absolutely free rein. Success breeds self-indulgence. What was effectively bittersweet turns toxic. When my difficult heroes, and all real heroes are difficult, self-destruct, I retreat and reassure myself that it's safer here, close to shore, where I live. I distance myself from the disaster, but I gawk in glee. No less assiduously than anyone else did I study Tiger's Sexts to and from Jocelyn James. I want the good in my heroes, the gift in them, not the nastiness, or so I pretend. Publicly, I tisk-tisk, chastising their transgressions. Secretly, I thrill to their violations, their psychic or physical violence, because through them, I vicariously renew my acquaintance with my shadow side. By detaching, though, before free fall, I preserve my distance from death, staving off difficult knowledge about the exact ratio in myself of angel to animal. In college, reading all those Greek tragedies and listening to the lectures about them, I would think rather blithely, well, that tragic flaw thing is nicely symmetrical. Whatever makes Oedipus heroic is also... What did I know then? Nothing. I didn't feel in my bones, as I do now, that what powers our drive assures our downfall, that our birth date is our death sentence. You are fated to kill your dad and marry your mom, so they send you away. You live with your new mom and dad, find out about the curse, run off and kill your real dad, marry your real mom. It was a setup. You had to test it. Even though you knew it would cost you your eyes, you had to do it. You had to push ahead. You had to prove who you are.
David Shields lives in Seattle. How Literature Saved My Life is his 14th book. Look for more information about him and his books at mtpr.org/twq. Hey, thanks for listening. See you next time.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau, Lisa Simon, David Moore, and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis.